Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa's John Papa John Entrepreneurial Center and their National Science Foundation I-Corps Training Program, helping faculty, staff, and students make an impact with their innovations and research. More at iowajpec.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Iowa Week 2020, listening to Black voices. And all week long, I've been talking with Black Iowans about their lives, experiences, and ideas. This hour, growing up Black in Iowa. I'll talk with Rakeshia Harrington of North Liberty about her childhood, raising her kids, and working with young Black Iowans. Erin Haggerty was a teenager when her family moved to Iowa City from Northern California. I'll talk with her and her dad, George Barlow, about that experience. And my first guest is Eric Harris. He is a dad who lives in Iowa City. He has six kids ranging from 4 to 19. He also has firsthand knowledge of the criminal justice system and what it's like to be a Black man in that system. He has 3 felony convictions on his record, but he's rebuilt his life and worked very hard to advocate for the restoration of voting rights for felons in Iowa. He is on the line with me now. Hello, Eric.
How's it going?
Great. Thank you so much for talking with me today. And first things first, we're almost to Election Day, and I know that when the governor restored voting rights to people with felony convictions, it's not that simple. There are outstanding fees that can keep somebody from voting. So it was a bit of a struggle for you, but you have right to vote restored?
Yes, I did. And I would like to also point out that there's a difference and there's a misunderstanding about the fees and the fines. At first, it was all fees and fines. And then now it's just changing to like restitution, because it was kind of unfair that it was some individuals who owed fees and fines for jail stays or administrative fees or court fees, and they for a while had excluded those people as well. But now those people are not excluded. It's only the people who owe like victim restitution.
Gosh, what does it feel like to know that you'll be heading to the polls?
It makes me feel very empowered. So empowered that I know there's opportunities to do absentee ballots or like mail-in ballots, but I feel so empowered that I dedicated a full day to stand in line and cast my vote.
You also have a 19-year-old daughter, so she recently got her right to vote, turning 18 years old. Are the two of you going to go vote together?
I'm not sure about that because our work schedules conflict, but if we do have the chance to do that, we will do that.
Eric, let's talk about being a dad in this environment. You've got 3 sons, 3 daughters. Your kids range from 4 to 19. That sounds like a really busy household. Tell me just a little bit about your family.
It's a very busy family because my 19-year-old works, I work, and my wife works. And then we have e-learning going on at our house as well. So our house is not only a house, it's a schoolhouse as well, too. So it's kind of it's a busy, busy, busy time in my house on most days, except for weekends. That's when we kind of get to chill and relax and do other things. But during a typical like week, Monday through Friday, it's pretty hectic. We don't really have a set schedule of when stuff is going to happen. We plan around what's going to happen. So we know that. So we have to, get lunch together, and we have to make sure the kids are staying on task with their classes, and also I have to follow my work schedule. Then my wife has to follow her work schedule, and then we want to do stuff to our house that we need to do, like painting and things like that. So it becomes very busy, and I would like to give a shout-out to my 16-year-old right now, because he's been kind of the head of my household right now, because he's been doing his own e-learning, plus making sure that my younger children do their e-learning as well, plus while we're at work, he's been cooking and cleaning and all type of things like that.
Wow. Well, that is really impressive. So he's probably their IT support as well when you're not there.
Yes, definitely. And I have a big, big like gift for him in store. I think they're coming out with one of those new video games, a PlayStation 5. And he doesn't know it, but he's going to get one.
All right. I hope he's not listening to the radio. But he's probably studying right now. So where did you grow up, Eric?
Chicago, Illinois. I've lived in Iowa for about 20 years. I definitely was in trouble when I was lived there in Chicago. I definitely was involved with street gangs. I definitely was involved in street violence and getting myself incarcerated, doing things to put my life in danger. And it got to the point to where my mom was like, hey, you got to get out of here. You got to find something to do, because it's not, you know, the path that you're going on is not going to lead to anything but destruction.
And why Iowa?
I had a family member that lives here, and he kind of went down that same path. And then he came down here to Iowa, and he kind of got his life, you know, in order. So when my, like, mom, when she seen that and saw what he did, she thought, well, maybe that'll work, you know, for Eric, you know, and that's what she did. Unfortunately, when I got here at first, I continued to do things that, you know, I was still, you know, I was continued to get in trouble, and it took me a while to just calm myself down.
Well, it's Iowa City, Cedar Rapids, other cities in Iowa have become a place of refuge for some people trying to escape that violence of larger cities. Did this feel like a refuge when you got here?
Yes, definitely, because after I got here, more things happened in the city of Chicago. They started tearing down affordable housing. The violence increased even more, and it just seems like it just can't. It doesn't stop increasing. It seems like every year it gets worse. They took upon a gentrification project in the city of Chicago, which most people, low-income people, can't afford to live once they gentrify those areas. They can't afford to live in those areas. So, you know, it definitely felt good, you know, because, you know, right now, you know, I can't afford to pay $4 a gallon for cigarettes or $20 an hour for parking. You know, it's just not a place for people of low income. And I think that that's the whole stated goal, that they want to move some of those people around. And some of the other states that surround Illinois are kind of bearing the brunt of that, because, you know, we have a lot of people that are moving from that city to Wisconsin, Indiana, Iowa.
Iowa is not a utopia, obviously. It's not paradise. We've got a number of things going for us. But tell me, as a dad, when you think about the fact that you're raising your kids in Iowa City, how do you think their experiences will be different from your experiences growing up?
Occasional violence in Iowa City, you know, that's everywhere that you go. So they don't have to be, they don't have to be exposed to just constant violence like I was, you know. It's almost to the fact that it gave me PTSD almost, you know. I think I might get it. I don't know. It's just not diagnosed, you know. And also, it's a very diverse place. And that was the thing. That was one of the things that I didn't have when I grew up. I grew up in a neighborhood that was 99% African American. And so it's a very diverse place. You know, like, I can go across the street and my neighbor is Latinos, or I can go to the house on my right and my neighbor is Asian. I can go down the road and my other neighbors, they're Africans. So I feel that, like, I feel that that gives them a chance to, you know, learn about different cultures, you know, learn about different things. And also, Iowa City is a very different place from most of Iowa, if you ask me. There's a lot of things that's going on. There's a lot of organizations and a lot of programs and a lot of things like that. Now, there is some negative things, and in the past couple of days, there was a negative thing that I had to sit down and explain with my kids about, and it was an incident with a Iowa City officer where he was accused of racially profiling a person, and it was all in the news, and I had to explain to my kids, you know, and it's kind of sad that I have to explain to them, like, hey, you know, you guys are kids of color, so if you ever have interaction with, like, law enforcement, just pay attention to what they're asking you, listen to their commands, and if they did something wrong, we can go back and deal with that later, but don't make an encounter with the police turn into a negative encounter. And it kind of it's kind of sad that I have to explain that to my children, because I would think that the officers would have enough training that I wouldn't have to explain that to my kids. But I think it's my responsibility, because I can't rely. This officer has enough training, so I can't rely on that. It's up to me to speak to my children about how to deal with cops during, you know, interactions.
We know that here in Iowa, Black Iowans are overrepresented in the criminal justice system, overrepresented in our jails and our prisons. Do you talk to your kids about that and about your experiences with your felony convictions?
Sometimes when my kids do some things that I don't like and I need to, like, discipline them, or I need to, you know, talk to them about something that they did, sometimes, like, I'll share a story with them, you know, from something in my past. You know, it's not just, like, try to glorify something like that, but I'll share a story with them, you know, about, you know, being 18 years old and sitting in, like, a solitary cell by myself for 23 hours a day and just not knowing nothing to do and, you know, not knowing when I'm going to get out the cell, and, you know, or, you know, I share any, you know, I'll find any story I can, because it like impacts them, because they was like, well, I only heard about these things, but now he's telling me he's been through these things personally. So I definitely share things from my past to let them know, like, hey, if you don't cut this out, you know, this could be you being incarcerated at 17 years old, or, you know, this could be you, you know, getting people shooting at you, or people chasing you around, or, you know, just any of those bad situations, you know. So definitely.
Do you feel like you can prepare your kids? Do you feel like they have a better shot than you did when you were their age?
Yes, I do. Because they have me to warn them about the things, you know, because it's some kids and they have parents, and their parents, you know, fortunately, they lived a good life, kept their nose clean, kept themselves out of trouble. So they can't really share those graphic details of what it's like to get locked up or get yourself in trouble. Or, you know, they can't share that because they fortunately did a great job in their lives. So they can't get those experiences. And so I feel like my kids have, you know, a better shot because they can see the things that I've been through. And they also watch me climb out of those things. So, yeah, definitely.
Eric Harris, thank you so much for talking with me.
Yep, thank you. Ask me all the questions, and I'll tell you the truth about the boys in blue.
Little boy, little boy. When you get old. Eric Harris is a father of six who lives in Iowa City. He was a strong advocate for the restoration of voting rights for people with felony convictions in Iowa. We will continue with our conversations in just a moment. This is Iowa Week 2020, listening to Black Voices on Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa's John Papa John Entrepreneurial Center and their National Science Foundation I-Corps Training Program, helping faculty, staff, and students make an impact with their innovations and research. More at iowajpec.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Iowa Week 2020, listening to Black voices. Approximately 4% of the population in Iowa is African American. That number has been going up, but when the Barlow family moved to Iowa City from Northern California in the mid-80s, there was some culture shock, especially for a Black teenager entering high school. George Barlow and his daughter Erin Haggerty shared their memories of what that time was like through a StoryCorps interview that aired on NPR this summer.
I remember one time when I was sitting at an assembly, and when I got out, my hair was filled with staples. Someone had just stuck them all through my hair. It took me so long to get it out. And I was just mortified and so deeply hurt because I knew all the people sitting around me, but no one stopped them. No one said, hey, someone's putting staples in your hair, you know?
That is abuse. And I had no idea that you were going through that. I think I was just so happy that I didn't have to worry about you being shot at or chased down the street.
Erin Haggerty and George Barlow talking about what it was like for Erin as a Black teenager living in Iowa City in the 80s. George lives in Grinnell, and Erin lives in New York City now. I had the opportunity to talk with both of them together, and you will hear the N-word in this interview. George, I want to start with you. Take us back in time. When you decided to move your family here, you had already lived in Iowa once before that, right? As a student at the Iowa Writers' Workshop?
My favorite professor and mentor, Michael S. Harper, who just passed away a couple of years ago, sadly, told me about the workshop in Iowa, and I ended up coming. And Aaron was born in Iowa City at Mercy Hospital.
Oh, wow.
So this was kind of a return for her, too, when we came back. But that's it. And I was just mostly enchanted. I mean, it was a culture shock, as you mentioned. I think Iowa's a beautiful state, despite the strong winds and the unusual snowstorms.
George, I want to talk a little bit about your childhood, because you grew up in California. And when you were growing up, tell me what your experiences were like with racism. That was something that you encountered.
Yes, and this was I'm a child of the 50s, and it was just in the air. We were kind of gently segregated. My neighborhood is 409 houses, an all-black, working-class neighborhood, and right next to us was an all-white working-class neighborhood. Our neighborhoods were as close as you can imagine, but the railroad tracks literally divided our neighborhoods.
But you met in school. So while the adults were, as you said, gently segregated, the kids were together.
That's right. And, you know, we got along fine. We got along just fine. We were on our teams together. And, you know, but I was aware of these things. My father, my parents divorced when I was four. But you know, I spent a lot of weekends with my dad. And I remember him taking me to see somebody named Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And I thought, boy, that's a long name. You know, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. at the Oakland Auditorium. And it was a big deal. He told me to be sure to tell my teacher when this was a Sunday afternoon. He said, when you get to school tomorrow, be sure to tell your teacher that you saw the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. So I told her, and she was amazed. What I didn't tell her is I didn't know which one of those men up on the stage in the suits was Martin Luther King Jr. I didn't know which one was talking.
You have talked about the fact that your mom wanted you to learn to play the accordion. And
yes,
taking my condolences. Taking accordion lessons, that took you into a white neighborhood. What was that experience like, other than the accordion playing part?
I took a bus. I was old enough to ride the bus by myself. So I took a bus into that neighborhood. And it was roughly where our high school is. But, you know, I remember walking down the sidewalk and not seeing anybody out, but, you know, being called nigger from somebody behind a fence somewhere, you know, and I did not like it. I didn't appreciate the accordion then. I didn't know about Zydeco music and Tejano and how wonderful accordions could be in music in France and Spain. But I did the best I could for a little while. It didn't go on very long. But I really hated, it was scary. It was scary and it angered me.
Did you tell your mom about that?
Yes, I did. I didn't tell her at first because I knew how proud she was, but I kept it to myself. You know, I told my buddies that was no surprise to them, but I finally told her that I didn't want to do that anymore. And she understood and didn't try to force me, you know. But we had that kind of thing going on. But yeah, I saw some real cowardly behavior from my young white fellows. They would never confront us face to face, but they'd ride into our neighborhood at night sometime, you know, like small southern cities, you know, hoot from the car. I remember them peppering our windshields, our car windows with BB, because it was a real cold night. And, you know, if you shoot a BB into or pellet into a windshield, it's just going to ruin it.
Back to 1987, when you decided to move your family to Iowa, George, I mean, again, you had lived here before. Mm-hmm. And were you concerned about what it would be like for your black kids in a very white town at that time in Iowa City?
Yes, I was, but not as concerned as you might think. Because by the time their mom and I left Iowa City the first time with our little baby, our little one-year-old daughter who just started walking, I had really gotten attached to Iowa. And when we moved back to the Bay Area, I was teaching at Berkeley. That was my first job. I had a secret. My little secret was that I missed it. I missed Iowa. You know, I missed a lot of the natural things about Iowa, the nighthawks and the cicadas, and, you know, the changes of the seasons, as extreme as they are. I really, really enjoyed that.
So, Aaron, when you and your siblings gave the stamp of approval to Iowa in 1987 and you came back, it's pretty clear that you had heard some pretty romantic and positive stories about the state when you came back. So tell me what your experience was like. You know, your dad was talking about how school when he was growing up was very different from the community that he was living in. That's still the case. What was it like for you to go to school in Iowa City?
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting because I hadn't thought so much about being one of the few Black students at school. I was more concerned with, you know, was my fashion going to be on point? You know, like, was I coming from California with like a certain hairstyle that wasn't going to go over well at school? Like, those were the things that I was nervous about, but I was so excited to start high school because, you know, like 16 Candles and Breakfast Club, I just had so many great ideas about what high school life was going to be like. And then, you know, when we arrived, you know, I quickly made some friends in the neighborhood. And so I was excited that at least I would know a few people, you know, in school that could, you know, hopefully show me around and be my friend. But I just remember there was one night, it was, I think it was like maybe the first week of school, and I was walking with a few new friends from the neighborhood, a mix of girls and boys, and just casual conversation. I think I was really shy and kind of quiet, but I just excited to be a part of something. And then someone used the N-word, not directed at me. It just came up casually in conversation. And it was like the biggest slap in the face. I couldn't believe that I was experiencing something like this. And I think what made it even more challenging is that someone said, hey, you know, I don't want to say any names, but hey, so-and-so, you know, Aaron's here. And the reaction was, oh, sorry, Aaron, you're not like that though. You know, I was referring to someone else and you're nothing like that. So I just remember feeling like shock and then kind of bad that I didn't have the courage to speak up and say, well, you shouldn't use the word at all. Because it was almost like he was trying to give me a backhanded compliment by saying that he didn't think of me that way, that I was okay, you know? So that was kind of the beginning of my high school career.
When you encountered that, did you tell your family about that?
I didn't. I didn't want my parents to worry. I didn't want them to think they'd made a bad decision in moving us to Iowa. I also didn't want to seem weak. You know, I before that, I think I would have thought that I would have been strong enough to stand up for myself if I were ever in situations like that. So the shock of not speaking up was a lot to bear for me.
In this week of conversations that I've been doing with Black Iowans, a theme that comes up again and again is this sort of Iowa nice veneer. And, you know, the term Iowa nice gets used in a lot of ways, in positive ways and negative ways. But this veneer that hides racism, where people will smile at you and say the right things, but then maybe they're saying something else behind your back, or they'll say something that really undercuts that veneer. Aaron, was that your experience?
Yeah, and I'd love to talk. I think the word racism is such a tough word because one of the things that was hardest for me to deal with, besides situations like that, was that people would say to me, you know, I don't see color. I want you to know that, you know, that I don't see color. I just see you as my friend. And It comes from a place of extreme kindness. And like, I know there's a sense of welcoming there, but it was always so awkward for me to hear that because it's a mixed feeling. It's kind of like saying, I'm your friend in spite of your being Black. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, is that a compliment? Like I think what was hard for me is like, I'm really proud to be Black and I would love to talk to anyone about my culture, about how I grew up, you know, my experiences. And it almost felt like that shut down that ability to have those conversations with people, because it was almost like, I don't want to have these conversations with you.
We're talking about your experiences in the late 80s. And one of the things that has really grown out of this summer, out of the Black Lives Matter movement, as it has really blossomed in so many ways this summer, is a truth-telling experience, similar to what we saw when hashtag MeToo emerged. We're seeing a lot of people sharing their stories about what it's like to be a Black American, be a Black Iowan. And you, of course, were in the Iowa City School District. Iowa City is one of the more liberal towns in Iowa. It's one of the more diverse towns in Iowa. And I think a lot of people are honestly shocked to hear negative stories about racism in Iowa. It sounds like the stories you were telling could have happened yesterday in Iowa City.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you feel, Aaron, when you think, oh, you know, that was over 30 years ago? Kids are still going through the exact same things now.
Yeah, I think what I've been thinking about a lot lately is I've been trying to remember what it felt like to be the only, you know, and in my case, you know, one of very few Black students in my school. So that means in most of my classrooms, I was the only Black student. On my soccer team, I was the only Black player. And that kind of deep isolation, you know, I just remember going home and just feeling kind of exhausted because I would, you know, smile all day. And I think I worked really hard to seem content and okay. But honestly, I think that a lot of my memories are just feeling kind of really tightly wound, very anxious, worried that something would come up, like that I'd have a racist experience. But just that being the only in classes was very, it's a lot to bear. It's something that people don't really think about. And I would love if people would feel open to talk about these things and try to just think about what that would feel like. Like if you are, say, a white student in class, like just try to think about what it would be like to enter, you know, say a restaurant and think about what that might feel like if you were a Black person. Like for me, even now, you know, I'm 48, that when I first walk into a restaurant, the first thing I do is that quick scan of the room to see if there's anyone else that looks like me or even if they're, you know, Latino or Asian, just to see if there's someone else that instantly makes me feel like a little more comfortable. Otherwise, if I am the only Black person, I have to have that little conversation with myself. Like it is absolutely okay that I'm here. It is okay that I can sit down at this table and order this meal and enjoy it. These are things that Black people have to think about all the time, and it is very exhausting.
I taught at a small Catholic college in Iowa a year before I took the job at Grinnell, and we had this great reception, you know, welcoming new faculty and just kicking the year off. And I happened to be the only Black person there. And one of the administrators came up to me, and I could, you know, sometimes you can see it coming from a mile away, right in the middle of our little casual conversation. He said he wishes I could meet his auto mechanic. So he said, yeah, he's a colored fella, and you'd really like him. I said, no, I don't want to meet him. I know too many Black people already. I thought that was funny. Scared him to death. And sometimes the best way to handle that is with a little humor. You know what I'm saying? So that was my way of saying, man, chill. Just chill. I don't know anything about you. I don't assume you're a racist or have any Black friends, but, you know, just take it easy.
George, when you listen to Aaron talk about the challenges that she had as one of the few Black students at her high school and one of the few Black students, you know, in different sporting activities or being the only, and knowing some of the things that she heard other kids say or that she saw and experienced. How do you feel thinking back, knowing what she was going through?
Well, I realized that she was getting an education in living in America that I didn't know at the time. You know, she was learning those important lessons that I learned as a kid. I did not know that was happening because she's still very close with some of her white friends from high school. And I am too. And, you know, I got to know their parents. But I'm sure I would have, I'm almost afraid of how I would have reacted.
Erin Haggerty and George Barlow talking about what it was like for Erin as a Black teenager living in Iowa City in the 1980s. In just a moment, I will talk with Rakeshia Harrington of North Liberty. This is Iowa Week 2020, listening to Black voices on Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Iowa Week 2020, listening to Black voices. My next guest, Rakeshia Harrington, serves on the City Council in North Liberty. She is the Iowa City Special and Underserved Populations Recreation Supervisor through Iowa City Parks and Recreation. She grew up in Waterloo and is a mother of three. Rakeshia, thank you so much for being here. And I want to start with your childhood. You grew up in Waterloo. I grew up in Cedar Falls, Iowa, right across the river, and that metropolitan area is one of the most segregated in the country. Tell me a little bit about what it was like to grow up as a Black girl in Waterloo, Iowa.
Well, you know, being surrounded by such a huge family, I mean, my mom is the youngest of 13, so I have a huge family. And my grandmother, you know, was very active in the community. She was one of the grandmothers who fed everyone. And we always had, like, family and friends, and everybody was invited. So as a young person, you don't really realize how segregated things are because you're surrounded by love and you're surrounded by people who look like you that, for you being a young person, look like they're successful, right? And so that's what it was for me. It wasn't until I, you know, got older and moved out of Waterloo and come back, because I left at 18. So you start hearing different stories and things. So I would say that I felt like I was, you know, my friend choices were very diverse. The company we kept around the house was very diverse. And yeah, I was surrounded by a lot of people of color, but my neighborhood, we had Hispanic people, white people, we had a lot of Black people, but it was, we were kids and we were friends.
So leaving gives you a different perspective. So what do you think you know or have learned about the environment that you grew up in from being out of it?
I think, you know, you start paying attention to how the police, how you see police as the number one thing. But in terms of education, you know, when you go back and you realize that there's not a lot of businesses, you know, restaurants and so forth, or just stores to go shop at on the east side of Waterloo. And it's just like, but you can go other places and see it, and you start seeing just how little investment is put into place where mostly people of color are living. You know, certain things that you just like, oh, this is so sad, and just missed opportunities, especially for young people.
You became a mom at the age of 15. I know that this is something that you want to talk about. That's a tough, tough age to become a mother at. What was that experience like?
So, had I not been surrounded by the people that I was surrounded with, it probably would have been really, really horrible. I wouldn't say that it was a glorious time. You know, I was still involved in my schooling. I still excelled. I just missed the graduating from the top 10% of my high school class. I think for me, having my child at that age was probably a blessing because it pushed me harder to kind of prove the naysayers wrong, right? Just to still exceed and to still have a vision of what I wanted my life to be. And I have the most amazing parents. They were heartbroken because they too had so many, you know, dreams for what my life was going to be like. But I can say that between my teachers, my counselors, my friends, just the community that I surrounded myself with, my church family, people, you know, didn't turn their back on me. They pushed me to say, you know what, you're going somewhere anyways. And my kids are like the best thing in my life. You know, they turned out pretty awesome. So I would say, like, for me, it worked out. And my husband, well, he's my husband now, but he was my high school sweetheart. And he's the father of all three of my children. So I would say we worked it out and we figured it out. And it was not easy. I did have to miss out on several things, you know, some of the parties. But when I talk to my friends, they say, like, well, you really didn't miss anything. So, you know, they would have rather hung out with me and my baby anyway. So.
Well, and that baby is now 23 years old.
Correct.
And she is a college graduate, recent college graduate before the pandemic struck.
Yes.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. And she's doing amazing. Like, she's got to do a lot of things that, you know, I didn't do because, I had her. But that was one thing that I got to tell her is, you know, you don't have to make the, and I don't consider her a mistake. You know, babies are a blessing in either way. And I would say that it just taught her that she could still achieve and do a lot of things. So.
You also have two other kids. So 23 to 12 is your age range. You've got a lot going on. And you have committed a lot of your life to working with children. Why did you decide that's where you wanted to put your energy?
Well, because children don't have a choice in this world, right? I mean, they have a choice, but they come into a world that adults already mess up. So I figured if you can instill anything and encourage them to accomplish and be great in whatever it is, then you can start at a young age. And so me working with young mothers was something that I have always been passionate about just because of my own personal experiences. And I knew if I did not have the people that was in my life to instill those positive things, then who knows where I would be right now? Who knows what kind of kids I would have? And so I wanted to continue to do that. And kids are just so amazing. They see the world with such innocence, right? And so it's our job to keep it that way, but it's also our job to say, like, the world is very cruel. And when you run up against these roadblocks or, you know, these barriers come, or when this situation happens, like, you can't give up. You have to keep trying over and over. And I just wanted to continue to be a positive light. You know, I don't wear a badge on my shoulder or on my chest to say, hey, I was a teen parent, like, be like me. No. If that conversation comes up, I share it with them, but it's also to tell them, like, even if something like this happens, like, this turns your whole world around, literally upside down, like, you can make the most out of it and be the best.
You work for Parks and Recreation in Iowa City now, but you spent time working for the Neighborhood Centers of Johnson County, and which is a nonprofit organization that works with young people, often lower socioeconomic young people, very diverse communities in Iowa City. And you created G World for young women in these communities. Tell me about G World.
So G World, actually a colleague of mine, called me, like, she had got called to do like a focus group, and both she and I had been working in various arenas with young people, and so when the opportunity came along to kind of do a focus group to see, like, how could we work with these young ladies and kind of find out what it was that they wanted to do in meeting, like, weekly, and so that's what we did. And it started with 7 girls at City High. And it evolved into over 170 something girls within a 5-year time span in 6 of the secondary schools in the Iowa City area. And initially, it was specifically for young Black girls. They were having issues up at the school where there was a lot of fighting, just a lot of cattiness. But they also needed somebody to tell them that they had potential to be leaders, and that they could succeed and they can do the same things that their white peers were doing. And so once we did that, it became more like we were their mothers in some cases, or they aunties, or their big sisters. And we started taking them places like plays and movies and just having real conversations that I know that was important to me from my older cousins or, you know, mentors. And that's how we started. And it just grew because it became a connection where they got an opportunity to see women of color in leadership positions. And they also had a safe space to have a voice.
We, of course, are here in 2020. We've all been living through this pandemic, and we know that it has hit communities of color far harder than it has white Iowans, white Americans. And we're in a school year that is different. A lot of kids in the Iowa City district are going to school online. A lot of kids, more than 40% of the students have chosen the online option, and the rest of the kids are doing hybrid education. So kids are on their own a lot more than they ever have been before. What do you see? What are your worries about how we're coping with this? And are we providing the kind of opportunity to all of the students that we need to be providing?
Yeah, I think my biggest concern is just the mental well-being of our students, especially our students of color. And like you said, coming from many of them coming from, you know, more disadvantaged families, that they already don't have the resources and necessary tools to, you know, succeed. And so you have an additional barrier where that disconnection is. And I think that's more concerning than anything, because there's already a education gap, a huge one that's now becoming a crater, right? And so trying to figure out how do you catch them up and how do you communicate and how do you help them address all the additional crises that they were already going through, in addition to now having to either choose to do hybrid or be remote on days or whatever they chose, but knowing that there's still the issues of they may live in a mobile home park where they don't get great reception, or the internet just does not work. And so when you think about how many kids probably have not even logged into any of their classes yet, they're already set back and even further.
Right. And we also, in the midst of this pandemic, we had George Floyd's death.
Yes. And so you deal with all of that. And when you see it played over and over and over, no matter if it's on the news, I mean, everywhere you go, it's there. Like, as an adult, I mean, I had to check my mental health and figure out what it was and how to disconnect and keep myself, you know, from sinking into a deep depression. And it's real. But when you have young people who already are trying to just figure out life, you know, they shouldn't have all of that pressure on their shoulders.
I want to talk about your political career. Mm-hmm. You are the first woman of color elected to the city council in North Liberty. Congratulations.
Thank you.
On that. What made you want to run for office?
Well, it took a little while to get there. But the opportunity presented itself. And after working with other people on their campaigns and just watching, you know, being in the background, I never was a person who wanted the spotlight, right? And so just watching other people and seeing and realizing and just learning more about how local government actually continues to have the greatest impact, and also working with so many families and advocating for them over and over, you realize that if you don't have a seat at the table, it sometimes what you're trying to get across is like going on deaf ears, right? And so you can try to push the agenda a little further and really see how things are handled from the inside out. And also, I just wanted to be an example for other people to say, you know what, like, you can do this. You don't have to be an expert, and you don't have to say, well, when I'm ready, when I have all of these, you can learn as you go. And it's okay to make mistakes along the way. But it's also even better to be in a position where people can hear different viewpoints. And that's what I wanted to do. I don't claim to represent all people of color in North Liberty, but I also know that this opens the door for other people to say, like, you know what, I can do that, and ask me questions about the process. I would love to pass the torch.
Are you tired? What a year to be in
it's
leadership.
It's been a year, but I also know that I'm a hands-on person. And I like to be very involved in the community. And I get that as a person of color, you have this dual role where you're so invested in your community because you know you need to help them. And I'm not saying that the other council members aren't. They have their passions and their ends. But I also know when you're working with oppressed groups that often don't get their voice heard or don't have representation in places, that it's double duty. And sometimes you're challenged in ways to say, you know what, I'm hurting and I want to scream and I want to punch the wall and I want to react in ways. But I also know that I have to keep a level head. And sometimes you feel like you can't do both. You know, you're wearing these dual hats. And I think that needs to change because it is a lot of pressure. And I won't say that I won't forever, you know, I won't be in this role for a long time. I don't know, you know, who knows where my life will go, what direction it will go, but I'm glad to be here and embracing this moment. I'm glad to have been in a position to help when, you know, people really need a help. And I will continue to do that once I'm not serving in council.
This past summer has shone a light again on the systemic racism in our culture, and hopefully people's understanding of that has grown. I've talked to a number of people who are like, you know, white people discover this every few years, and then it just goes back to normal. But there are a lot of people right now who want to make a difference. Where do you want to see people focus that energy?
I want them to focus wherever they're passionate about. And you, like I say, you don't have to be an expert. You just have to care. And if you have a heart and you're passionate about that, then start small. I mean, start a carpool or you know, a book club, something, wherever you're passionate about. You don't have to be an expert. You just have to be passionate and care about it.
Rakishia, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me. This has been a joy, and I really appreciate you all allowing this opportunity to happen in this conversation.
Rakishia Harrington serves on the City Council in North Liberty. She is the Iowa City Special and Underserved Populations Recreation Supervisor through Iowa City Parks and Recreation. This is Iowa Week 2020, listening to Black voices. Tomorrow, we talk about the power of art in the movement for racial justice. Music, visual art, poetry, and storytelling. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.